Welcome to Soundings, conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support provided by the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and by Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
Literature and the Law, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation with literary scholar Mark Rose of the University of California. Later in the program, you'll hear commentary about patterns in contemporary publishing from the former director of the Princeton University Press. For readers, teachers, and critics, literature is art. But from a legal standpoint, it's property. I talked about that difference with Mark Rose, a recent visitor to the National Humanities Center. Mark Rose is director of the University of California Humanities Research Institute. He's currently at work on a book entitled The Author as Proprietor, a study of the emergence of copyright in 18th century England.
Well, the word itself comes into being around the early 18th century. Before that, one spoke of copy, just as copy, and the word copy referred to both the manuscript, the physical manuscript, and also to the right to reproduce it. And when you move from copy to copyright in the 18th century, that you also move from one system of thinking about these matters to a completely different system of thinking about these matters.
Who defines the notion of authorship? How far back do we go before we say, here is our first professional author? Or I'm not asking you to give me, you know, to nail that down. I mean, in the mists of time. But in conceptual terms.
Well, the notion of authorship changes. It develops. And it's very much related to other kinds of social and cultural and economic events. In the Middle Ages, an author was always somewhere else in some other place. It was somebody who was dead. It was an authority. Aristotle was an author.
Right.
Most manuscripts in the Middle Ages circulated without any names on them at all. Or if there were names, it might be the name of the scribe who wrote the manuscript.
Now, this wasn't humility on the part of the writers. This was simply the social convention.
Exactly. It was a wholly different culture. It was a wholly different system of thinking about things. Then in the Renaissance, you start to get, along with other kinds of individualization, you get the individuation of an author. You get a Dante. You get a Petrarch. You get a Chaucer. And when you start to get individuated authors in that way, then you start to get concerns with authors' rights.
Let's get back to the history of copyright in the sense that there are certain, what, key dates here. You mentioned again before our taping, 1709. What happened then?
In 1709, you get passed a statute, which is the first copyright statute in the world. It's in Britain. It's called the Statute of Anne, which is just a reference to Anne having been the reigning monarch at the time. And what's remarkable about this statute is that it vests literary property in an author.
Rather than just what? It's just sort of floating out there somewhere. It doesn't belong to anybody.
Well, before the Statute of Anne, the system of regulation, and it was more a system of regulation than of property as we know it, was principally a guild system. All the printers, this is true in most countries in Europe, the printers of a country were organized in a guild, like a shoemaker's guild or a draper's guild, a printer's and bookseller's guild, in England known as the Stationer's Company. And the Stationer's Company, in order to regulate its own trade, had a system whereby a particular printer would, or bookseller, would register the name of a particular title in their own name.
And they owned it, what, in perpetuity, forever and ever? They could print this thing?
They had a, ownership is a funny word here. What they had is a system of rights and responsibilities in relation to the guild. And one of their rights in the guild was now the right to print that work, which was a right to prevent other people in the guild from printing that work.
All right. Now, you've talked about a century-long struggle between two sets of booksellers. Tell me about how does that connect to copyright?
What happens is that through various cultural developments, this company, the Stationers Company, loses control over the publishing industry.
Well, this is a political phenomenon here, not necessarily a strictly cultural one, I take it.
That's correct. Yeah. It's a political phenomenon, very much so, because the losing control is connected with the disappearance of censorship, of state censorship.
So it doesn't have it doesn't necessarily begin with the making of money. It has to do with freedom of expression. That's interesting.
It also has to do with the making of money.
Okay. let's not lose sight of that.
Let us not, because the Stationers' Company had control. There was in the 16th and 17th centuries, after the spread of printing, the government, the state, and the guilds, in effect, have an exchange in which the government grants the guild the power to regulate the industry.
And what does the guild give back in return?
The guild polices discourse.
I see.
The guild helps to implement censorship.
Uh-huh. Do we associate this with dark words like ideology and thought control, or is that too harsh?
Those are anachronistic, but they're certainly the early modern states, the states in the 16th and 17th century, were very much concerned with control of discourse, control of conversation. Mm-hmm. They did not want blasphemous or libelous or seditious words to be promulgated.
What about sexuality? I mean, we hear stories about how on the Elizabethan stage, for instance, there is a great deal of blatant randiness, today audiences won't sit still for it, et cetera, et cetera.
Sexuality wasn't the issue.
Okay.
Blasphemy, sedition, those were the issue. Let me take you back to 1709. The key thing that happened in 1709 is that the statute identified the author as the first owner, proprietor of a literary work. And this is, in England, the first time that an author now has legal standing as a figure who could conceivably go to court.
Now, standing, the shorthand for that
is... Legal standing, that means could go to court.
Yeah,
would have a right to sue.
Authenticity in the courtroom.
That's right.
Okay.
It can be recognized as a person who could take some action in a courtroom. And authors simply had no standing, had no right, had no grounds on which to take any kind of legal action.
Mm-hmm.
Now, authors don't immediately flood into the courts. And that's also interesting. They don't flood into the courts because authors are not, by and large, making their livings from dealings with booksellers.
So in other words, we really haven't come to the moment when authorship is a bona fide professional kind of vocational
enterprise. That's correct. That's going to develop, amongst other things, as the market for books develops to the point where the market can sustain professional authorship. And that happens in the course of the 18th century. And in some ways, looking at it this way, so the first professional author, you might say, was Samuel Johnson. Now, certainly Johnson is the person who made professional authorship. Johnson, remember, is the man who said nobody but a blockhead ever writ but for money. Johnson is the person who made professional authorship respectable. The earliest cases in which an author goes to court, the earliest case that is that we have records of in considerable detail and that some of the crucial issues get focused on is a case that occurs in 1741. And that involves Alexander Pope, who was suing a bookseller, Edmund Curl, a bookseller who was an antagonist of his. And the issue was letters.
Letters that Pope had written what, to his friends?
Letters that Pope had written to Jonathan Swift, and that Jonathan Swift had written to Pope, and there were some other people involved.
So there was a sense of audience here. This wasn't just one man's ego. This was Pope saying, in effect, look, I've done something that's circulating out there. Other people are reading it, and therefore I'm entitled to some kind of a remuneration.
Maybe. Pope's motives are very, very complicated.
Yeah, you can't get back into his mind.
Well, you can get some sense of some of his purposes, but one of the interesting things here is he would never have acknowledged that his purposes were primarily commercial in this matter. His motives were very complex and very mixed. You can excavate some of them. He sued under the statute, which statute established him as an author, saying that the letters that he had written to Swift were a literary work, and the letters that Swift had written to him also belonged to him. And a court now had to make a number of decisions that were really crucial and interesting.
Isn't this interesting, Mark Rose, that people who are not primarily literary, i.e. judges and lawyers, are going to make decisions about what is primarily literary. They're going to tell you, they're going to tell an author what an author is, and the author's coming in saying, no, that isn't necessarily what I am.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that's fascinating about this Pope v. Curl case, because a judge has to sit and decide whether letters, personal letters,
are literature.
Or in the terms, yes, our literature, but in the terms that the statute was written, this was a statute for the advancement of learning.
I see.
And so the issue becomes, are these letters learned works? And the defendant, the bookseller Curl, says, they're not learned works. He's saying, I'm going to meet my friend.
We'll have coffee and so.
Exactly.
Well, let's come to the point. What did the judge say? On whose side did the judge land?
The judge landed on the side that letters are indeed learned works because they're very profitable, and often they are more profitable for individuals to read the less premeditated they are.
And that kind of pattern, moves right into the modern world.
That is the moment that establishes letters as literary property.
Mm-hmm.
But your point, what you were saying, is here we have a judge making a literary judgment, a judge making a categorical judgment. Letters fall into the category of learned works.
Isn't this a little depressing to you writers and you publishers? I mean, after all, that no matter how hard you work, all of your work, all of that aesthetic sweat that you're pouring off, it really comes down to a legal proposition, not a cultural one and not an aesthetic one.
No, it's fascinating because the legal propositions are very much cultural propositions. Issues of aesthetics are deeply embedded in general social issues, and the law is, after all, an institutionalization of social imperatives of various kinds.
So it's not out there. It's involved in our literary as well as our practical life.
Absolutely. And in the case of this case about letters, we are constituting the canon of what is worthwhile, and we're doing it through the instrumentality of the law.
Mm-hmm.
The law is doing it. There's a further development that happens here. I slipped it by, but I didn't open it up. Let me open it up a second.
Fair enough.
Pope was suing. The Statute of Anne gave an author the first ownership of their own works. Edmund Curl had published a volume which was an exchange of letters between Swift and Pope. Pope was suing, claiming ownership both of his letters and of Swift's letters, which is wild in our own terms. He was claiming ownership of his letters under the terms of the statute, and in principle, at least, he was claiming ownership of Swift's letters because they were written to him.
Now, on the grounds of what? Sort of a creative symbiosis? Without my letters, his wouldn't have occurred?
No, not at all, because he owned them, because he had them.
I see. The physical ownership.
It's not that explicit in the documents.
Uh-huh.
But that can be the only basis of the claim. The bookseller, Curl, denies that Pope owns either Swift's letters or his own letters.
Uh-huh.
And so the judge has to decide who owns the letter.
And he decided in favor of Pope.
No.
He didn't, not in this case.
He splits the difference. What the judge does...
Solomon.
What the judge does is decides that the recipient of a letter owns the paper and ink, the material letter, the writer of a letter owns the words.
The ideas.
The words.
I see. Not the ideas.
Not the ideas.
All right.
Although the distinction between words, between expression and ideas has not quite been made. It will be made shortly, necessarily. But you see what's happened here is that the words have been separated out from the material basis, mm-hmm. from the physical ink and paper, and we've constituted now a text as a property rather than a book, which is a physical object. Booksellers were concerned with books, with physical objects that were vendable, that could be put in the window of a bookseller's shop.
But prior to that, we have expression, we have creativity, we have concepts and ideas and words.
That starts to become formulated at this point now.
Mm-hmm.
And those expressions, ideas, concepts now are being turned into property. And you can watch, in a case like this, you can watch that emerge as a property that did not exist before.
It's almost like biology. It's an evolutionary kind of thing.
That's right. And it's a, in one sense, it's very particular, specific issues that force the definition in a certain direction.
Mm-hmm.
The particularity of there being the statute on the books, which allows Pope to sue, and then the particularity of this case emerging around letters. And because it's around letters, a certain kind of decision has to be made. Who does a letter belong to? And so you start the process of defining what a literary property is.
Let's bring this this whole notion of copyright and authorship into the 1990s. Again, before our taping, I told you my wife gave me a Christmas present, a book of insults back and forth between mm-hmm. publishers and authors. They really hate one another, apparently. Are we therefore to say that things have changed for the better, or they haven't changed an iota since the beginnings of modern publishing and authorship that you've been describing? What about it?
Well, I don't know that publishers and authors really hate one another. I've had a very close and amicable relationship with one publisher, Harvard Press, for 25 years.
Uh-huh. I'm thinking, for instance, of a story about Stephen King, who had to come up. He had to give away the rights to a half a dozen books in order to get out from under a contract with one publishing house and go with another. No, I mean, we can say, all right, he made a mistake, that was bad judgment, mm-hmm. but that is not typical necessarily of the relationship between publishers and authors.
I don't think so, but when you have somebody like Stephen King, who is generating extremely valuable commercial properties,
uh-huh.
and there's a great deal of money at stake, you then get into areas of friction,
mm-hmm.
as you do also, say, when you employ a contractor.
All right, and it goes to the notion of property. That's the peculiarity. That's where the lawyers come into a courtroom.
That's right.
And say that your creative power, after a fashion, takes on, it is analogous to something that we can own and hold.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
And that comes about historically, the development of that notion comes about historically in the course of the 18th century. When I see a cultural process at work, when I see, let us say, choose a classical example, Milton transforming the epic tradition in Paradise Lost, Milton in Paradise Lost really versifying large portions of the Bible,
mm-hmm.
What I see is a process of transformation. But terms like originality?
No, that's too dignified. That's too big.
It's a little problematic when applied to that.
Uh-huh.
Now, what do you do, on the other hand, with a signed bicycle wheel as a work of art, originality?
Yeah, this is a wonderful emblem of the interplay between what we call, what used to be called high and low culture, I guess.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
Exactly. So in our own culture, for many, many reasons, these concepts are stretched and are in fact breaking down. And I believe myself that things like the electronic transmission of texts will put even more strain on these concepts. and how the law will deal, how our culture will deal with this, since ours is a culture based still on the marketplace, on private property, I don't know. But it's a problem.
Mark Rose is a literary scholar and director of the Humanities Research Institute at the University of California, Irvine. He's at work on a study about authorship and the emergence of copyright in 18th century England. You're listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Authorship and Publishing continues with commentary by Herbert Bailey, former director of the Princeton University Press. Although university presses reflect the sophistication of contemporary scholarship, their scope isn't as inclusive as you might expect. Herbert Bailey recently conducted a study of a decade of academic publishing in the United States. I asked him to comment on that study.
Even as late as 1952, when I made my first trip abroad as a young book publisher, the signs of World War II were everywhere. In the European cities, there were still piles of rubble. Some kinds of food were scarce. I also found a sharp hunger for American books, which had been almost unavailable in many parts of Europe for more than a decade. Dollars were scarce, and libraries were hard-pressed to make up for years of falling behind. Scientific books in particular were in demand. America had a lot to offer the world then, and it still does. The United States had lived in a kind of isolation before the war, but now the world was opening up, except behind the Iron Curtain. We wanted to spread our language, our culture, and our industrial products. But what did we bring back? Were we correspondingly open to knowledge and culture from other countries? I don't think so. In time, American universities established programs in Asian studies, African studies, Central European studies, Near Eastern studies, and the like. While many were good programs, there weren't enough teachers of these subjects, nor were there enough interested students, even though a need was felt. Our eagerness to send our ideas and products into the world was much stronger than our interest in that world itself. Consequently, special academic programs about most regions of the world remained small, in part because they required knowledge of difficult languages. Few students majored in them, so the number of professors did not grow rapidly. But, paradoxically, the professors who teach in such programs are the same scholars we depend on now for the knowledge we need in this extremely complex world. And for the future, we depend on their students. Have we been active enough in expanding our understanding of these other cultures? Where do we stand now? The past decade has been marked by turmoil in Latin America, China, Central and Eastern Europe, South Africa, and the Near East, among others. Because these are important areas in the world scene, you might assume they would be major subjects of academic study. Yet, of the representative sample of research books that I surveyed, how many do you think were devoted to these subjects? Here are the figures. Latin America, less than 4%. China, just over 2%. Central and Eastern Europe, including Russia, less than 4%. South Africa, just over 1%. And the Near East, less than 2%. Together, these subjects add up to only 12% of the total. While Japan looms on our skyline, when we look at Radio City in New York, for example, only 1% of the books I surveyed were about Japan. These numbers must be compared with the fact that over half of the books and half of the energy for research was devoted to America, Britain, and Western Europe, ground that has already been heavily plowed. Is it sensible that such small percentages of research effort were devoted to areas that we desperately need to explore? We need to know other languages, other histories, other politics, other religions, other economies, other cultures. Scholars can help us do that. The publication of advanced research provides a measure of scholarly activity, but the problem can't be solved solely by scholars. In our colleges and universities, the history and culture of the West are popular subjects for undergraduates and, consequently, for advanced research. That may be understandable, but it also perpetuates an undue emphasis on the West. What about non-Western history and culture? Recently, President Bush has spoken of a new world order to emerge from the war in the Persian Gulf. Can we have a new world order without understanding the present order, the array of cultures that now exist around the world? Leaders in education must break this vicious circle by curriculum revision and through fresh thinking about faculty appointments and fellowships. Moreover, this change should extend downward into the high schools and elementary schools. We live increasingly in a cultural as well as economic global village. Accordingly, we need to redirect our studies, our research, and our academic publishing.
The comments of Herbert Bailey, former director of the Princeton University Press. Under the sponsorship of the American Association of University Presses, Herbert Bailey recently conducted a study of a decade of academic publishing in the United States. The program is Soundings, Conversations and Commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Authorship and Publishing is available on cassette. For a copy of the preceding program, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 585. That's program number 585. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes, and when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings.
You've been listening to Soundings, a program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Next week, conversations about biblical narrative and Christianity during the Reformation. Wayne Pond will talk with scholars from Indiana University, the University of Leiden, and the University of Vienna. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please listen again next week at this time on this radio station. Partial funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Literature and the Law, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For teachers and critics, literature is art, but for lawyers, it's property. Mark Rose, a literary scholar from UC Irvine, will discuss that difference. You'll also hear from Herbert Bailey, the former director of the Princeton University Press, who comments about trends in academic publishing. Authorship, Property, and Publishing Today. Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.